Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We have a packed show in front of us today. Coming up in just a bit, terroir. Wine lovers use that term to describe how place shapes what's in the glass. And in Tom Ezern's Plainsfolk essay, he uses that idea as a metaphor, exploring how landscape, culture, and memory give human communities their distinctive flavor. And as the Arctic warms, indigenous communities are looking for ways to adapt. We'll hear more about that in Our Living Lands. We begin Main Street today, and as 2026 approaches, Congress is facing a familiar deadline with high stakes for millions of Americans, including many here in North Dakota. Enhanced Affordable Care Act subsidies are set to expire at the end of the year, and without action, health insurance premiums could rise sharply. Earlier, Conversations on Healthcare spoke with two reporters who closely cover the federal healthcare debate about where negotiations stand and what may come next.
Well, Sandhya, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare. And Robert, thanks for joining us for the first time.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Well, here we go again. The Obamacare subsidies are set to expire at the end of the year, and Congress is really facing another budget deadline of January 30th. I wonder if we could ask both of you to assess where things stand and what the chances are for a compromise.
Sure. I feel like right now we have a lot of different moving pieces, but not a real sense that any of these things are going to make it across the finish line. We're gearing up towards two votes in the Senate, one from each party on Thursday on their plan for how to deal with this crisis. It looks like both of them are going to just be party line votes, not move forward. And in the House, we're kind of waiting to see what House Republicans are going to share with us that they're trying to do. But I think the main thing is that there are a lot of different plans bubbling up, but none of them have enough support to really make it into law.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. I think right now there's not a lot of consensus on the Senate side. It seems like Republicans and Democrats are barreling towards a side-by-side vote that was agreed to by Senate Majority Leaders soon as part of a deal to reopen the government, I think last month. And so, but there wasn't a guarantee that a subsidy extension would pass. So right now, what I think is kind of interesting is that there's more compromise on the House side, I think. There have been some Democrats and Republicans, primarily more vulnerable Republicans, those in tough races next year, are getting together and formulating proposals like an extension of the enhanced subsidies, but with some reforms. But right now, there's not been any indication from Speaker Johnson that he is going to be advocating for any of the compromise legislation that's being discussed at the House.
And the White House has provided no guidance at all. Is that right?
Well, yeah, there was the President Trump did float a two-year extension with an income cap, among some other changes. But that was quickly scuttled after opposition from a lot of rank-and-file Republicans. And right now, we haven't seen really any endorsement from President Trump. He did interview with Politico's Dasha Burns, an interview that released today. Shameless plug, you can catch it on our homepage, where she asked him about this issue, and he basically reiterated the push for a direct payment, that he wants the subsidy to be instead a direct payment to Americans rather than what he calls a bailout to insurance companies. So nothing new right there in that interview.
Well, it seems like wait and see and maybe compromise are the three operative words of the day, with maybe on the compromise. But thank you for that. And this question maybe picks up on that. Sandhya, we have been hearing that some Republicans want to avoid sending the subsidy funding to the insurance companies, but their alternative is to put it in individuals' health savings accounts. So what's the status of that idea at this point?
So I guess as of just, maybe less than an hour now, we had Senate Majority Leader John Thune kind of tee up that what the Republicans are going to vote on this week is a proposal from Senators Bill Cassidy and Mike Crapo that is kind of similar-ish to one of the things that, that Trump has talked about putting money in those accounts. And so that legislation was, you know, formally unveiled yesterday. You would get, if you were eligible for this, between $1,000 and $1,500 per person on the plan per unit, with some different reforms attached to that. The issue, I think, is that, you know, we haven't really seen, there are no Democrats that have said that this is something that they want. Even among some of the Republicans that you talk to, it might not be their ideal plan, but they're planning to vote for it. So that's what we're kind of watching there.
You know, Robert, you talked earlier about the president with his HSA idea, the one he'll support. But the practical reality of setting that up seems like something that will take quite a time to implement, right? I mean, that's not easy to do. And all the negotiations around that seem like that's almost dead on arrival.
Well, it's interesting. I've talked to several state-run insurance exchanges, and it's important to note that open enrollment for the ACA 2026 coverage year has started. It started for most states on November 1st. And a lot of the state-run exchanges have told me that they can get a clean extension of the subsidies implemented within about 2 weeks. Most states have kind of allowed insurers to offer two sets of rates, one with the subsidies and one without. They obviously approved the rates without the subsidies, but they have the rates, with this enhanced subsidies and calculated in the hopper if they need to go. They've told me that anything like an HSA would take longer, and because it's just more complicated. And also, it's important to note that under Cassidy and Crapo's plan, to get an HSA, an ACA customer would have to buy a bronze tier plan, which is different from a silver or gold tier option. A bronze tier plan has much lower premiums, but they have higher deductibles, and they also have higher copays than the other options.
Makes it very difficult for consumers to actually use the health insurance that they have, although I guess the preventive measures would still be upfront covered. But Cindy, you've reported that a bipartisan group of House lawmakers also is talking about extending the Affordable Care Act tax credits for two more years. Does this have any legs? Do you think that's going to garner support?
So we have a few different bipartisan groups trying to do this now. I think the one of the earlier ones was a group of four that was doing a two-year with some of these different guardrails, you know, capping how much income you could have to be eligible, minimum premiums, things like that. But since that original one, we've had two more. We had one at the end of last week with about 30-some members from both parties in the House that, you know, there's like some minor details in between each of them. And I think the problem that we've had is each time we've not gotten a strong sense from House leadership that they would take this up. And then I think, interestingly, if we have another one today that came out with from Representatives Fitzpatrick, Suozzi, and others, which is a little bit of a kind of in the sweet spot in that it kind of combines the two-year extension with parts of the HSA proposal. And so I think that'll be interesting, just what the reaction is to that as the House comes in this evening, just because it is a little bit in the middle and a lot of the other ones have been a little bit more formally in one camp or the other. But no kind of strong sense that we would even get a vote on any of these, even if there's support or not.
You know, Mark, I can't help but think back to when the ACA first came into being and these kinds of questions were being debated in town halls and high school auditoriums and reported on daily. But we really don't have any kind of major public ongoing communication in a very palpable way, I think, out in the communities.
No, that's absolutely right. Sandhya, you know, the other part of this really tricky situation involves abortion. And Republicans want stricter abortion limitations in order to extend Obamacare funds. That seems like a non-starter for Democrats, is it?
It is. I think that it has come up a little bit more and more as we've, you know, get in these conversations. If you talk to some of the at least from the Senate side, some of the Senate Democrats that have been part of the bipartisan negotiations with certain Republicans on, you know, can we come together? Can we find some sort of compromise? That's the thing that they've been saying over the last couple of weeks, that, you know, this keeps being a non-starter, that they absolutely want language that would prevent, if you have a plan that would cover abortion, from being eligible for the tax credit. And that complicates things, given that there are several states where all coverage, private coverage, is going to have that in some ways part of their plan. So I think we've seen a lot of more lobbying on that in the last couple of weeks, too, from, you know, abortion rights groups, anti-abortion groups, all just kind of, you know, saying that if you don't go one way or the other, that's a non-starter. And I think that's been making it a little bit more complicated and sort of finding a middle ground.
Well, we've been talking about deal making, and Robert, we all like Washington to reach deals when that's possible, seems to move things forward. But you've also reported that some in the conservative movement believe that the Obamacare fears are overblown.
Wondering the flip of this is that polling shows Democrats, at least now, winning on the health care issues after the government shutdown. Wondering if you can give us an overview of where the broader public opinion sits right now.
Sure. So there's been, I think, some polling, I believe, from KFF, which is a nonpartisan health policy research, that shows that a majority of both Democrats and I believe also Republicans have been in favor of extending the subsidies. It's been harder, I think, for conservatives to manage and get that message across that these subsidies are a net negative for consumers. And it's been an issue that has plagued conservatives for a while when it comes to healthcare policy, including whether or not they wanted to make cuts to the Medicaid expansion during Obamacare repeal in 2017. It's kind of a question of whether or not conservatives, how much will this hurt conservatives? It, you know, remains to be seen. I think that it's important to note that what I said earlier, that ACA open enrollment has started, and there's been a lot of auto enrollment that is still occurring. But some experts say we need to wait and see until January, when people will see their first premium payment and be like, wow, I don't want to pay this. And then that's when you might start to see some shifts. But states have already been telling me that they are not seeing as much newer enrollees. These are people that are not on the exchanges and would not auto-renew. They are seeing fewer new signups this year compared to prior open enrollments.
But not fewer people, right? It's just that it hasn't grown? Is that what
there's a certain portion that will auto-renew every year, and then there's they also have a certain portion that will come in and want to get coverage for one reason or another. Either they, you know, have changed jobs, or they've, you know, recently been able to gain access to subsidies or something like that. But I believe I talked with one state that said that they are seeing fewer of these new signups so far this year.
Which may translate to more uninsured people.
That's right.
Period. Yeah. Well, I'm going to turn away from the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare for just a minute. Sandhya, we'd love for you to tell us about your reporting on the new number two person at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He's an outspoken critic of mass vaccination. That obviously is troubling to many. But what are you hearing and reporting on?
I think the timing of them kind of rolling out this you know, number two at CDC is interesting. So the former Louisiana Surgeon General, Ralph Abraham, is, you know, now the number two at CDC. They announced this shortly before they had the ACIP meetings to, you know, discuss all sorts of vaccination things just last week. And I think, given his past comments, you know, as you know, he's a former member of Congress, but he's also, in his role as Louisiana Surgeon General, you know, he's amplified a lot of like vaccine skepticism. He's opposed, you know, mass vaccination for like the flu, and also been a pretty strong proponent of ivermectin as a COVID treatment, which is, you know, been debunked. And so I think that as we see a little bit as what he's going to be doing, that'll be interesting. He's also criticized Bill Cassidy, who held the Health committee. And that sort of, you know, aligns a little bit with the back and forth that there's been between Health Secretary RFK Jr. and Cassidy. So I'm kind of curious, you know, what we'll see from him, especially since.
So it's not right a now, Senate confirmed position then, I assume?
Yeah.
For making those
and
attacks?
We don't have a CDC director at present after Susan Meneses was fired earlier this year. And so I guess in the wait for someone to be nominated by Trump, for that to kind of go through that process, there's less control from Congress and just, you know, less oversight in terms of what's going to be done then. But it seems like it's going to be more on this MAHA agenda. Abraham has spoken pretty frankly about being a proponent of MAHA. And so I think those are the kind of things that I'll be kind of eyeing and just seeing at CDC in terms of how they're going to address communicable diseases, but especially on vaccines.
And very interesting, I think we're seeing states taking things much more into their own control with their departments of health around their recommendations, what they'll pay for, what they'll provide to communities. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this shakes out.
Senator Cassidy, have any buyer's remorse in terms of the secretary's position, or is he just being held down by his conservative base?
I think he's a little cryptic in kind of how he responds when he's asked on some of these things. I mean, he will go after specific comments, like after ACIP last week, he said, you know, he was disappointed in some of the things related to hepatitis, especially given his background, you know, working on that issue for many years as a physician. But I think he's kind of stopped short of just saying anything too strong. I mean, he's still also up for re-election coming up. And I think it's a tough position to be in when some of the things that you might be looking for are not kind of playing out.
Facing a primary or not? I forget.
There have been people that have expressed interest in primarying him.
Yeah, absolutely. Robert, another big change in 2026 is the adjustments to the Medicare physician fee schedule. Basically, highly paid physicians are getting a bit of a cut in their reimbursement rate, and primary care doctors are getting a boost. But to the rescue, the AMA is really fighting back. Tell us about their initiative and how successful it might be.
Sure. So this is an issue surrounding the physician fee schedule, which sets the physician payment rates for Medicare for the coming year. And this is the first one that has occurred under the new administration, and it makes some interesting changes to kind of how the payment rates for certain types of physicians are calculated. For a while, the American Medical Association has a committee of doctors, and that includes several different specialists that offer kind of these payment rates. And there's been concerns among physicians that the payment rates for primary care has lagged behind other more higher paying specialties, and it is filtered down to whether this will limit primary care as a desirable type of field to go into, especially since it's very expensive to go into medical school, and a lot of doctors will go into one of these specialties because they have student loans to pay off. So the CMS really tried to make a change to this where it bumps payments for family medicine and general practices by about 3%. And at the same time, it lowers the payments for some specialties. Like for instance, neurosurgeons will have a 5% pay cut, but in some respects, a specialty could get a higher pay increase. Like an allergist will take home an extra 7%. So this is part of this action done by Dr. Oz, who is actually a doctor, is part of a larger examination, I would say, that the RFK's HHS wants to take on the AMA. They are concerned that the AMA has too much power when it comes to setting rates and policy for Medicare. For instance, there's been concerns about the diagnosis codes, which is the code that a doctor will submit to Medicare to essentially get reimbursed for service. These codes have been created by the AMA as well. So there's concerns whether or not the codes have been properly developed over time. And that's, I think, another fight that we should look for on the horizon surrounding this, because this is a issue that RFK in particular has championed, in addition to many, many others.
Margaret, Robert just mentioned student loans, and I think the whole profession, the whole healthcare industry was taken by surprise when nurses were sort of relegated to a much lower level in terms of healthcare coverage, in terms of student loans. I'm wondering, where did this sort of arise from? I think the nursing world's certainly very concerned about the change that happened. Any sense of what was the motivating force to make those changes?
I believe that was, something that the Department of Education had created, and it's part of a larger reform effort that they're doing that they're looking to do over there. They're looking to, it's creating what is the definition of a professional degree, and they wanted to reclassify graduate nurses as graduate instead of professional, which could limit the student loan amounts that nursing students could get. Mm-hmm. Nursing organizations have really been pushing hard against this. They think that it is a harmful policy for the profession. So we'll see where this goes.
We'll have to do another show on that sometime, because it has a potential very adverse impact on the pipeline, certainly in terms of primary care as well as acute care settings. But I wonder if I could just get us to focus for a moment on the fact it's also open enrollment season for the Medicare Advantage plans. And generally, I think almost since Medicare Advantage plans were created, the Republicans were big supporters. But that there started to be some cracks in that facade. Tell us where you think things stand in terms of continued support for the Medicare Advantage plans.
Sure. So I think that Republicans still love MA. I think that Democrats, well, more centrist Democrats, I think progressives are not fans of MA. But I think that Republicans still love Medicare Advantage, but there is a growing chorus of concerns surrounding the program. The Republicans are concerned about the high amount of prior authorization care denials, which require a doctor to get insurer approval before delivering a prescription or delivering care. It's become a source of frustration for doctors, and Republicans have generally seen and heard that frustration. There's also concerns about spending. Republicans have wanted Medicare Advantage spending to be in line with traditional Medicare, and that's just not the case. And they've been very critical of that. There's been a bipartisan bill called the Upcode Act, which is co-sponsored by Jeff Merkley and Bill Cassidy, that would clamp down on some of these issues that they say are driving higher spending in the Medicare Advantage program. So I think that Republicans are still very in favor of Medicare Advantage, but there are definitely targeted reforms that they want to make to the program.
I know we only have a few minutes left, but let's ask each of you what you think the big healthcare story of 2026 will be.
I think to put it all under one umbrella, I think affordability and, the forms of that will be a big thing, whether or not we get any sort of deal on ACA or some of the other things that have been in the mix. I mean, Congress has been very interested in PBM reform and things like that to bring down health costs. So I think going into next year, regardless of what happens in the next couple of weeks, that'll be definitely something big to watch here. And I would just also add in, after we got the One Big Beautiful Bill passed into law this year, a lot of those things start getting implemented next year. So just in terms of how those play out, or if there are things teed up for 2027, just how states are figuring out that they will implement those things. So I think those will both be very big.
Yeah, definitely. And a few things that I'm really looking for are the implementation of the Rural Health Transformation Program. Right. It's a $50 billion fund passed with the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which I'm trying to make as OB3 as the acronym to be used. I don't know if it'll work. But that money, CMS is going to decide which states get a slice of that money literally in a couple weeks. And there's already Politico, we had a story about how some states are chafing that they have to adopt certain MAHA policies in order to qualify for that funding. So where that money goes and how it's spent is something I'm really taking a look at. As a CMS reporter, I'm also looking into, you know, some of the more changes that Dr. Oz has been making or wants to make to physician pay and to value-based care, especially several new models that they are rolling out and they're implementing. I think the other thing I'm really looking into is how states implement the work requirements program.
Right.
For the under OB3, which goes into effect in 2027. So states have about a year to set up this whole program and ensure that people don't get inadvertently lose coverage, which was a concern that some states had with work requirements, is that, you know, some people will drop off coverage even if they meet the requirements. So those are kind of three things that I'm keeping an eye on. And of course, we have the midterms and also, you know, MAHA within HHS, what could be the next change that we could see for the agencies.
Well, we'll be keeping an eye on both of you and on your reporting. And we want to thank you, Sandhya and Robert, for joining us. And thank you to our audience for being here. Remember, subscribe to our videos on YouTube, find us on Facebook and X, and please share your thoughts and comments about this program. Take care and be well.
You've been listening to a previously recorded conversation from Conversations on Healthcare featuring Robert King of Political and Sandhya Roman of CQ Roll Call. And we'll continue to follow developments in Washington as lawmakers weigh their next steps. This segment aired originally on Conversations on Healthcare and is presented again here on Main Street. Ahead on today's Main Street, terroir. Historian Dr. Tom Easern borrows that idea as a metaphor to explore how landscape, culture, and memory give human communities their distinctive flavor. Plus, as the Arctic warms, indigenous communities are looking for ways to adapt. That's still ahead. Stay with us. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and today in Plains Folk with historian Dr. Tom Easern, it's Terroir in Grassy Places. Easern reflects on how place shapes identity, moving from the northern plains to the far-flung grasslands of New Zealand and Australia, where history, culture, and even wine grow out of the land itself.
Terroir is a term deployed by wine enthusiasts, often with more mystique than precision. There is a sort of magic by which the environmental qualities of a particular place are supposed to pass through into the aesthetic virtues of the wine. What I understand from conversations with enological chemists is that, in fact, historically, the important environmental element involved is not in the earth, but in the air, in the form of ambient yeasts which are caught and make the wine what it is, for better or worse. With the modern intentional addition of prescribed yeasts, terroir is now a less meaningful term than expertise. As a regional historian, though, I still like to play around with the idea of terroir, at least as metaphor. The idea that all things great and small, particularly all things human, get their savor from the place in which they grow. It happens, too, that Dr. Kelly and I, prairie historians headquartered here on the Northern Plains, in our offshore research ventures, have landed in grassy places grown into significant nodes of the New World wine industry. For nigh on to a quarter century, we have explored the deep history of the Lindis, a semi-arid grassland district of central Otago, New Zealand. Sheep, fine wool merinos, are still a big deal in the Lindis, but grapes have come to loom larger in the public identity of the place. Some of the finest Pinot Noir in the world comes from this grassy place. That is a recent development. Indeed, I helped trim some of the early vines of the Lindis in the mid-1990s. And now, as historians, we incorporate viticultural developments into the regional history. This means we have to experience the enterprise in the field and in the glass. It's a tough job, but someone has to do it. Well, now we have crossed the Tasman into another study region, the Barossa Valley of South Australia, settled by German-speaking evangelical Lutheran Silesians in the 1840s. I've been writing about the discovery of common cultural antecedents I share with the people of the Barossa in matters both religious and agricultural. It was a comfortable zone for me as we drove into the region a week ago, as winter wheat was just about harvest ready. In addition to meeting our German settler compatriots and going over the ground, we also commenced familiarizing ourselves with the viticultural landscape, including a call at the Long Mile Winery, a truly historic establishment. The signature wine grape of the Barossa is Shiraz, a favorite of mine. Dr. Kelly has taken a shine to the lesser-known grape of the region, Grenache. We walked up to the oldest planting of Shiraz vines in the world, and at the cellar door, the lass in charge adjudged us worthy of pouring from a $350 bottle of Shiraz for tasting. That's a little rich for my farmer professor blood, but now I have a better sense of the elevated state to which the purveyors of Shiraz may aspire. More generally, through research at the State Library of South Australia, a wonderful institution, we got an idea of how wine may assume a central place in regional identity, which is good, because our next stop after the Barossa of Australia was the Biennial Conference of the New Zealand Historical Association held in Auckland. I was scheduled to deliver remarks on the method, the craft, yes, even the philosophy of doing regional history. Going through these things in other parts of the world with people who have different vocabulary and assumptions sharpens me for examination of historical affairs at home. The Barossa gives us an interesting study in place and identity. Certainly from the time of original German settlement forward, there was the basis for an ethno-cultural region, quite homogeneous and somewhat isolate. Many of the evangelical Germans were determined not only to hold on to language and culture, but also to avoid contact with the English-speaking outsiders. Come the First World War, however, the outside world came to the Barossa, determined to suppress the language and culture of the enemy. It happened there, as it happened here. All the more reason for German settlers to lie low and keep to themselves. All of which changed in the second half of the 20th century as the wine industry planted viticultural flags in far-flung parts of the southern hemisphere, such as the Barossa. There, developers found that Germans had been raising some grapes and making a little wine all along. This was a modest basis for commercial expansion. More to the point, German identity, once disparaged, was found to be a commercial asset if you're trying to market wine and develop a wine-based tourist industry. Here on the plains, our German antecedents have largely faded. In the Barossa, they are heralded publicly, but also persist quietly. If you go to the right cafe, you can eavesdrop on gentle German conversations among old residents. They have some stories to tell, I am sure.
That's another Plains Folk by historian Dr. Tom Ezern from North Dakota State University, where he's a distinguished professor of history. Terroir in Grassy Places. Plains Folk is a regular feature here on Main Street, exploring the history and meaning of life on the Northern Plains.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Magazine, formerly North Dakota Horizons. For more than 50 years, the bi-monthly publication has been celebrating North Dakota's great people, places, food, events, and history. Subscriptions available at NorthDakotaMagazine.com.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As the Arctic warms, Indigenous communities are looking for ways to adapt. Alaska Desk reporter Ayolna Niden spoke to Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding about the effort to preserve traditional ice cellars and more on St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea.
Can you describe what Savoonga is like for our listeners who haven't been there?
Yeah, so Savoonga sits on an island in the Bering Sea between mainland Alaska and Russia, and it's truly gorgeous. On one side, the village is backed by rolling hills and mountains made of black volcanic rock. In September, when I visited, the tundra was golden brown, glowing in that evening sun. The village relies on marine mammals for subsistence. So boats, as well as whale and walrus bones, are scattered across the coast. The village of Savoonga itself is small. It took me maybe 15 minutes to walk from one side to another, but the landscape around it feels vast.
And what are some of the impacts of climate change that residents of Savoonga are experiencing?
Residents say that the sea ice that forms around the island has been less stable and less reliable. And that's important because hunters use the sea ice for hunting marine mammals in the winter, for example, seals and walruses. Larry Kava is a local elder who says he has noticed the difference over the years.
It really, really affects our hunting. It started in the 80s. I try to tell the scientists our environment was changing. The water temperature was changing. They didn't listen.
Perry Pangobi is a Savoonga hunter, and he says that with ice disappearing faster, hunters find themselves out in the open water more, which means windier and rougher conditions for hunting. Pangobi also says that when bowhead whales migrate near the island, they usually tend to hang out around the ice edges, which makes it easier for the whalers to find them.
If there was a lot of ice around and there's open leads, it would be easier to run into whales. They would come closer to the coast to hug the island, but it's changing.
So yes, residents in Savoonga are feeling the effects of the changing climate in many ways.
Can you explain what a sikluwak is and how they are being threatened by climate change?
Sikluwak is a Yupik name for an ice cellar. It is an underground cache that indigenous people in the Arctic have been using for thousands of years to store food. But as the Arctic has been warming, residents in Savoonga and in other places say that permafrost thaw and erosion have been causing some of their ice cellars to collapse or flood.
You reported on some of the efforts to reimagine ice cellars in the changing world. What did you find out?
Yes, researchers from the University of Alaska Fairbanks have been looking at how villages in Alaska and also other Arctic communities in other countries, how they're reimagining the future of ice cellars. And what they found out is that despite the challenges and environmental changes, many continue using ice cellars and hope to preserve that practice. Michael Koski is one of the researchers working on the project. He says that while the climate is expected to get hotter throughout the century, the temperatures should fluctuate less underground.
If they're willing to go a little deeper and a little further inland, there's more of a chance of making a new cellar and maintaining those traditions.
And so people have been discussing potential solutions. For example, making new ice cellars at higher ground or potentially joining efforts in creating bigger community cellars. Koski says that in turn, Alaskan residents, especially elders, like storing food in ice cellars because the food takes on a certain flavor that they enjoy.
I think in all of these places, to some degree, there's a hold on to it because it's a tradition of the past. You know, it's an identity thing.
And is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners about your reporting from Savoonga?
In September, when I visited Savoonga, residents asked researchers about climate predictions, but they also stressed the resilience of indigenous people in face of environmental change. Elder John Wahagi says that Savoonga hunters continue to harvest marine mammals, and the warming is not detrimental to their way of life. He says walrus is one example.
They're still very fat, healthy. Polar bears are fat, they're healthy.
Overall, Alaska residents asked researchers about practical takeaways from their research to preserve ice cellars, and they also expressed interest in exchanging knowledge with people from across the Arctic and subarctic. In this way, researchers say that they hope this project can be a bridge between communities.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kuwanic Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, in partnership with the Good Relatives, announcing the 2025 Bush Prize Native Nations honorees, Minneapolis American Indian Center, Mokoche Agriculture Development, and Turtle Mountain Impact. Learn more at goodrelativescollaborative.org.
Some in the West pay high prices for water, while others get it for free. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The U.S. has been involved in another hijacking. Not the seizure of a Venezuelan oil tanker, but fossil fuels are involved. The Trump administration has helped to tank a U.N. report meant as a roadmap for countries to live sustainably on the planet.
The UN Environment Program released its seventh Global Environmental Outlook in Nairobi, Kenya last week. The report is the product of nearly 300 scientists from 82 countries, and its title, A Future We Choose.
Humans are at a crossroads. The choices are to invest in a stable climate, healthy nature, and a pollution-free planet, or continue business as usual.
If we can choose a path of incentivizing countries to move towards circularity, clean energy, and sustainable agriculture, and away from fossil fuels and plastics, there would be huge benefits.
Benefits like adding trillions of dollars each year in global GDP, avoiding millions of deaths, and lifting hundreds of millions of people out of hunger and poverty in the coming decades.
That was too much to bear for the United States, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Russia.
According to the New York Times, the U.S. did not attend the conference, but during final negotiations, a State Department official met with negotiators by video call.
The official said the U.S. opposed the final language on climate change, the need to switch to clean energy, biodiversity, and the use of plastics. The worst part of the call, one participant told the Times, was that the American representative didn't even have their camera on.
The BBC reports that in the end, scientists were unwilling to water down or change their findings, so the outlook has now been released without its customary summary for policymakers. The meat of the report, meant to guide governments around energy and environmental policies.
A new study from UCLA says cities in the West pay vastly more for water than districts that supply farmers, and that the price of that water doesn't motivate some of the major users to conserve.
The study shows that the price of water in the West does not accurately account for its growing scarcity at a time when all seven states in the Colorado River Basin are struggling to come to an agreement on how to allocate shortages caused by drought and climate change.
The researchers focused on the disparities in the price of water in California, Nevada, and Arizona, which make up the lower basin states of the Colorado River.
Based on historic allocations and complex water law, many water districts supplying agriculture pay little or nothing for wholesale water supplies, while some cities pay more than $2,500 per acre foot.
As the authors note, if water's being given away for free or close to it, then there's no incentive to conserve, and the shortage in the Colorado River Basin is accelerated.
They argue that water on its own has no consistent price, and that's a problem because it does not reflect growing scarcity.
The authors call for, among other things, a central database that tracks water prices and water rights, which could help officials and politicians to make better decisions as the climate becomes more arid.
A separate paper authored by the Colorado River Research Group states that reservoirs on the Colorado River used to hold 4 years' worth of water flows, but now they are less than a third full.
The experts suggest that the basin may never rebound from the aridification that's already occurred and will continue, of which climate change is a significant factor. They recommend creating a basin-wide entity where not only experts and political leaders, but also citizens can discuss issues. And finally, governments of 185 countries have agreed to protect the declining number of shark and ray species. Now, more than 70 different kinds of the animals will be included in an international ban on commercial trade, such as manta and devil rays and white-tip sharks.
The Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora adopted an agreement at the end of last month in Samarkand, Uzbekistan. The convention was first signed in 1973 and was aimed at conserving land animals like pandas, elephants, rhinos, and great apes.
At least one-third of these new protected species are threatened with extinction. Reef sharks have almost vanished from 20% of Earth's coral reefs. Manta rays are hunted and traded for their meat, which can be fed to animals or consumed by humans, but they're mostly used in traditional medicines to increase immunity and detoxify.
Shark fins are considered a Chinese cooking delicacy, and shark meat a source of protein. The cosmetic industry has used some sharks' livers as a source of oil for skin care and makeup.
These animals have not been protected before, unlike other species such as tuna, whales, and turtles, some of which have been safeguarded for 40 years.
Implementation of the restrictions and protections, which is a major challenge, will fall to each country, which will impose fines, ship seizures, or even imprisonment.
That's it for this week in water. Support our work at h2oradio.org by December 31st and have your gift doubled.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 16th. In November of 1896, Reverend Schermerhorn arrived in Wahpeton, leaving his pastorate in New Jersey. After correspondence with Eastern contacts who praised his work, local leaders secured his services. He came highly recommended by well-known Baptists and was offered the pastorate of the local Baptist church. The congregation was pleased with him. But soon, rumors began to circulate. Some believed he had come to Dakota to obtain a divorce, though the reasons were widely speculated upon. By February, newspapers commented on the situation. A preacher, after a divorce, makes an especially choice morsel for gossips, and the swift conclusion of many will be that Schermerhorn is a villain, one paper wrote. But it's only fair for the public to discredit groundless hearsay and suspend judgment until both sides are heard. Schermerhorn was nearing the 90-day residency requirement and planned to begin divorce proceedings in Fargo the following week on grounds of slander. On this date in 1896, Schermerhorn had filed for state residency. When offered the pastorate, he met with church officers and explained his intent to divorce, along with the reasons. They agreed to secure his services temporarily until his old friend, Reverend Van Horn, could replace him. One local paper even touted Wahpeton's divorce industry, writing, "The best treatment of room, first-class attorneys, and the best minister we have got at the windup. Our probate judge will go to his office at any hour of the day or night to fill up a marriage license or tie up the nuptial knot. Our district court is of high repute. Its excellent presiding judge is well known as a high-toned and learned jurist. The practicing attorneys before his court are also among the best this land affords, and the woods are full of them. We hope nobody will be discouraged who has grist to grind in our divorce mill. Our laws were made by fellows who have no desire to place any stumbling blocks in the way of those seeking to tear open the cold steel jaws of matrimonial alliances." Reverend Schermerhorn's brief, controversial stay in Wahpeton highlights both the public fascination with divorce and the unique reputation of the Dakota courts at the turn of the century. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lee Serdrick. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
NPR's Morning Edition jumpstarts your day like that first sip of coffee or cold water on your face. Wake up tuned into the world every weekday morning from NPR News.
Morning Edition, weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. Central on Prairie Public. Support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans.
And that's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll visit a family-run flower farm in West Fargo, Three Seeds Flower Company. They're bringing beauty to the community with backyard-grown cut flowers, dried arrangements, and floral products. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.